Blog Talk Radio.
This is Nazarita Goldhammer and Kevin Boylo, your co-host at Epis Radio, coming to you from the Rocky Mountains. It's October 7th, Monday, 2024. And we want to say that and thank our sponsors, the Existential Psychoanalytic Institute and Society, has been sponsoring this show from day one, and now the Earth Science Design and School is also supporting in many different ways our radio program. Well, we do broadcast currently from the Rocky Mountains on occasion. Cyclically, we will be broadcasting from the West Coast in California and also the Great Lakes region, and probably at some point back down into the Rocky Mountains in Colorado and further south and who knows where. We're mobile because we're internet-based and we go where we need to be. So we're talking about nihilism. And I want to just highlight a couple things here. Nihilism destroys meaning. That's its point. It destroys meaning. It destroys how we create meaning. It destroys the ingredients of meaning. It doesn't create any new meaning. Let's also understand that nihilism does not necessarily mean chaos or disorder. It is subtle. And this is the part that we want everybody to know. It's a subtle inhabitation of order, a curious viral invader. It's a denuding of value. This is the great concern. All values, all intrinsic values are put into question in a nihilist order. It hollows out what we take to be the good. It's an emptiness. It's a nothingness that squeezes out understanding. And therefore, the reality of the real becomes nothing. We lose common purpose, ontological maps, common expression of the good, and replace them with a singular type of emptiness, something that I think of as abject, matured abjectness, it's stillness. Right now, capitalism is its mode. Capitalism destroys all other meaning. It puts it into question. And so even though we have words and great books about other meaning, because the nihilist expression through capitalism is so strong that these other values have no force or effect. And that's the tricky part. People will say, but, and they'll point out a great organization or spiritual group or a book, and some kind of institution of something that expresses these great ideas. But that's the way nihilism works. And you can see it in every area of your life. So, and we've gone through this, the nihilist mode of capitalism. What are the effects? Resentment, hatred, sadism, complacence, indifference. And you can see it as you look out into the greater culture or your town, people you know. You can feel the resentment, the aggression, the hatred, the violence. And people want to enjoy life, so how do you enjoy life within that kind of ontology? You enjoy it through statism or indifference. We have violence. We have depression, anxiety, hatred, rage, emptiness, confusion, paralysis, addiction to having, depresencing, all earmarks of a nihilistic culture that lives in the mode of capitalism. Therefore, capitalism is a nihilism. It's a form of nihilism. So the idea is to try to tie together an understanding of nihilism and the paucity of empathy, right? A lot of people talk about the lack of empathy or the lack of sympathy, the lack of compassion, where people actively harm other sentient beings, whether they are humans or other, and they do it with indifference. And so I like to explain it as a displacement or a split offness from our authentic being, our self-connection, right? Our rootedness in our own self and rooting ourselves in the earth and rooting ourselves in life. And so this creates existential fragmentation where there's such a lack of coherence and unity within even one person. Here's a kind of a caricatured example. There are known serial killers who have led very normal lives. Very normal, really loving, important members of their family, dads and spouses and friends and community members, and they were off committing heinous serial murders. Nazarita, welcome to our show today. We're continuing to try to develop a conversation here about nihilism. And for me, the more I get into it, the more I realize that it pulls away at my very ability to think about it. As I think about it, it eradicates my thinking, kind of like the two-headed hydra. Welcome to the show. Let's talk about nihilism.
Thank you. So I was thinking of nihilism, which is really interesting how it infiltrates our language, because language is a reflection of a culture. So, you know, I just did a little bit of research on some words, like, for instance, terrific used to mean a long time ago that it was terror-inducing. And then it was meant to be, the meaning changed to intensely good. And now terrific means, you know, yeah, that's great. You know, that's terrific. It loses the meaning that it originally had. And, you know, I think of some things like unique used to mean that something was truly unique. Now it just really means that it's a little bit different from the norm, though not really totally unique. And there are lots of words, and then there are catchphrases that we still use in our culture that are embedded in our language, that are violent, that used to have a meaning of actual violence. Now we use them every day. People use things like, it's a dog-eat-dog world. And another one, which I absolutely hate, is called, you got this. You got this. Because it's said so often, the meaning becomes, it's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. It's a way of just saying you don't know how to support someone, so you say, you got this, meaning, you know, you can do it. But the other violent language, dog-eat-dog world, there are more than one way to skin a cat. You know, you're a pig. These animal uses of language that are they are in our culture, they're embedded, and they're violent, and their meaning still carries a violence in it, though it might not be used in the same way. It's and I think that there's something here. If we could change our language like you and I have talked about, we could actually change the way we are in the world. But a lot of these things keep coming up, you know, which we gather from a violent use of language that is nihilistic. It's meant to peg something. It's meant to stop all conversations. It's meant to degrade anything good in language, those violent terms that we use, and along with a lot of other things that we use when we call each other, a lot of men call women cunts. It's meant to be an abusive, nihilistic language that says that there is a violent, inherent violence in this. When we call someone names all the time, that's a violent use of language, which is in our culture, nihilistic. Because you are a master of language, what would you say to the nihilism involved in our embedded language that we use? Things that are obviously not real today, but we still carry them and abuse them and use them. And it seems like they carry on the violence in ourselves by the use of those.
Well, look at it like this. You've got a culture of experience. Everybody just imagine, close your eyes. There's a culture, there are societies within that culture. There's common language. And language directs us to experience. The whole point, it triggers thoughts and feelings and experience. But I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but if you have something called virtue or morality or pursuit of the good, you have a lot of language that words, a lexicology that directs us to those, the good words. It makes people think that we have those good things. So, for example, somebody might give $10 by check to a human rights organization in December. And then they can go out into the world and they can say, I support human rights. Or they can buy a T-shirt with a wolf on it and say, I support animal rights. So, in other words, we strain the boundaries of the real. Or we use the words like, and a lot of religions do this, compassion, a duty, a kindness. And you can be kind to somebody. You can claim to be compassionate and kind to somebody, but be harming them. So those intrinsic values, those anchor values, they used to be thought of as anchor values. You take your list of the great virtues, but they're used now. This is important that they're instrumentalized. They have a commodification value. This is really difficult to get. Once you get this, then we're into the open field of understanding nihilism. But nothing is of any intrinsic value anymore. Marriage, nope. Nothing like that. Loyalty, nope. Contracts, absolutely not. Everything has an escape clause, and everything can be used, misused, and abused. So all the important values that you think you've learned along the way in life, what living in a nihilist civilization does is it uses them against you. And then the other piece of this is that there's always a falsification of reality. You know, for example, Nesri, to take, I don't know too much about him, the Church of Scientology, for example, they do things to people who break the rules, but they do it because they're kind. They're helping people grow, helping them learn a deeper insight. And so you can see how they're completely misused. Or anytime you have a fascist government, or you have something like Mussolini or Stalin, Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump, they try to make you believe that certain things are true when in fact they're not true. And that's a big part of nihilism. Nihilism, if you're a person who's really confused, then that means nihilism is doing its job. So I don't know if this at all is responsive to your question, but the idea is that there's no anchor of meaning of any kind. And that's why I have to say this parenthetically. This is the value of phenomenology. This is the value of transcendental programs and some forms of meditation, not all meditation, but some forms of meditation. But it's about being absolutely as much as you can be in this moment of awareness of being. It's a palate cleanser. And it's very difficult for most people to get there. Even, you know, highly gifted people cannot get there. But once we get there, then we can see that there is existence within being. There's life. There's my breath. I am here. And you can start from that. It's like these are mathematical axioms. Believe it or not, they just happen to be ontological existential axioms. And you can actually build a whole social and political and moral framework based upon those super basic axioms. It's actually not that hard. But it means pushing to the side the noise in your mind. Because right now most people's minds are filled with total noise. And some people think they're thinking critically when in fact they're not. This is something that I think I would get your support in. So many people have consumed Kool-Aid. It's very different varieties of Kool-Aid, right, across the world. Tastes different, looks different, different ideologies, but it's all the same. It's Kool-Aid. And very little of it is going to help us grow as a human civilization. If you look at some of the theoretical critique of groups and organizations, you know, I've had this discussion. Groups, by their very nature, you know, like organizations, institutions, you know, groups, religious groups, spiritual groups, even philosophy groups, you know, the supposed seat of wisdom, there's no clean and pure authentic group experience. Groups are subject to eradication, immolation, self-destruction, implosion. And there's so much that goes on that's nefarious, that's destructive, negative. So you have to be really careful in life. And I've always said this, even when I was a very, very young person, you have to be really careful what you read. You have to be really careful what you read, and you have to be really careful who you associate with and what groups you, quote unquote, align with, if any. And this is one of the reasons why I do value, I don't idolize him, but I do value Krishnamurti, because he pushed us. Just like Ralph Waldo Emerson, just like Henry David Thoreau, Nietzsche, to think on your own, And I have been in and out of this experience. People want to belong. They want to belong to the language. Getting back to your question about words, they want to belong to the words. In the French, les mots, the words. And right now, I think we have a serious crisis in language. You and I have talked about positive dialectical experience of creating new language, new words, new forms of expression, new experience, new experiments in living. Isn't that really what it is? And so, I don't know. What do you think? Was there anything in what I said that was responsive to what you asked?
Yeah, you know, I really, really been thinking about nihilism, and I love Krishnamurti. I love that you brought him up. And one of my favorite sayings of his is truth is a pathless land. And he advocated not to follow any doctrine or teacher, guru, or authority, but to really, really look at what is really there. And I think of one thing in nihilism that, for instance, here's another good example of words, that when people do something that should be just a normal, virtuous, moral act, like saving someone from a car, right? Like everybody should want to do that. And yet if somebody does it, they're a hero. Or if they do something that right now people are more commonplace, they're apt to not participate in helping others. They want to ignore that it's going on. They want to not help animals. They want to just ignore it because someone else will take care of it. And then when someone else takes care of it, they call them a hero. And yet that value should be really what we all are participating in. We should all be that way. And then, you know, maybe nihilism is here to break up false morality, false honesty, false virtue. You know, for instance, if you ask a Christian, some Christians anyway, what morality is, they would say, well, only a man can marry a woman. A woman's place is in the home. There are no gay rights. And, you know, it's just like if you look at Hitler believed that everybody that was not white Aryan should be eliminated because they were lesser beings. To him, that was a very moral thing. So maybe nihilism has its place in rooting out that which is false virtue and morality, because we certainly, as human beings, have embraced a lot of false morality and virtue. I mean, burning people because they had a black cat, or, you know, these torture devices because people didn't look the same. I mean, we have this going on now with Trump, with Haitians, and it's like, where is the morality and virtue in that? And maybe that's part of nihilism, is to root that out and say, all the things that you thought were moral, like in your narrow-minded Christianity and that some people express, that maybe that's not true. You know, maybe that absolutely is not true. Like the Catholic Church is supposed to be highly moral and virtuous, and yet there are more pedophiles in the Catholic Church than ever. And so if you really look at that, maybe that is the, what would you call it, the job of nihilism, to say, maybe that morality is not really morality. Maybe that virtue is not really virtue. And then we have to scramble to say, what is virtue? What is moral? Especially
right.
If those things are confined in a narrow view.
The problem is that in the purest meaning of the word nihilism, we are denuded of our ability to think. We're stripped of our cognitive powers. We're stripped of our critical thinking. We're stripped of our whole toolkit, or what we thought was our toolkit. So I'm not in any way saying that what you're saying is not true. But what I am saying is nihilism, it's either going to be really bad, right, or really good. And so there's a negative form of nihilism and there's a positive form of nihilism, which you're calling attention to. The negative form of nihilism is that there will be total destruction and collapse of the human on the planet. And there's good evidence that this is happening, right? It's just absolute destruction of the human experience, absolutely. And so if we replace thinking, good critical thinking, by passion and power and just out of control force, right, the worry is that we will certainly become extinct, certainly. And remember, the leading hypothesis now as to why the Neanderthals became extinct is because they lived in isolated kin groups. It's really interesting. And I see a form or several forms of isolation in our Homo sapiens human experience. We are separated. We are. And so we have these things like racism and sexism, genderism, ageism, et cetera, that keep us all apart. And so there isn't much of a group experience, of authentic group experience. So what I hear you implying is that there's a potentially positive valence to nihilism. So let's say that we totally destroy ourselves and meaning. There may be, I think Heidegger called it the saving power or something like that. There may be a few people on the earth that survive, but they don't survive in the same way. For whatever reason, they're cloistered away, or they live in isolated regions of the world. Could be the indigenous, right? Some people in very remote areas of the world. And who would create a whole different kind of humanity? So your query is so provocative because, so one could say that the form of the human that we have now will most definitely end humanity. Most definitely go extinct, become extinct. The kind of human we have now is well on its way. But I think there's a suggestion in what you're saying that there may be a new species. That, I mean, species come and go. And there may be a new species that looks a little bit like the human, who's related to the human, but who's not the human. Or not the Homo sapiens human, but a different kind of human. Maybe that's where the saving power is. Maybe that's the positive. You know, creating value from the bottom up all over again. If I were a betting person, I would say chances are extremely high that humans haven't really stopped destroying the earth. I think we're going to end up destroying the earth, and I think it's going to cause a cascade, and we're all going to die. I mean, it happened to the dinosaurs, and they were a lot tougher than us. We had fires. This was a fireball. So it doesn't stretch my imagination that much to think that we will destroy this version of humanity. And I can still go along with your your thought that, that there can be a positive form of a new kind of humanity. And I think that's what we're trying to do at Earth Science Design School, a lot of the thinking groups that we have. But it's going to require a radically different kind of thinking. I think that's what you're getting at. We can't rely on any of the old ways of thinking about things because they don't work.
Right. I think that's really true. Can you even think of a time in human history where there wasn't nihilism? I mean, look at it. I mean, humans have had a violent run on the earth. And the ones that stand out to us, these thinkers that are actually critical thinkers, are the ones that we look to for guidance. And that, but I don't see any time where humans really thought as a whole critically. I mean, they follow one line in a Bible when the rest of it is saying to be kind, but one line says to destroy your enemy, and they will. And so I'm trying to think of any time in the human race where there was like this, they say that there was a golden period, right, where there was creativity and arts. And yet, if you really look at that, there was a lot of violence. And so that leads me to the same conclusion that you're expressing, which is humans are, we're dividing genetically to say who really is embracing a new kind of human and those who are not. I mean, if we look in the United States, our own election process, we have at least 41% of people who vote who are voting for a tyrant, for someone who is a rapist, and is a narcissist, and yet there are 41% of the population that are supporting him without any critical thinking at all, without blindly embracing something that is not even good for them. And so this is, I think, like a snapshot of humanity at this time. This is what's going on. It's gone on in every country, in every country around the world. There have always been despots who have governed. And it's like you have to wonder to yourself, why do humans let these people govern? It's because, you know, there are 41% of humans who are like that, who want the violence, who want destruction, and get enjoyment out of that, who want to kill everything. You know, hunting is a big thing in the United States. There's fall occurs and suddenly, you know, people are out hunting, enjoying killing other species for nothing, just for the enjoyment.
Well, look, here's the deal. I think some people have escaped nihilism in time. I don't think that we've been 100% absolutely completely in a nihilist anthropology. I don't think so. I think there have been pockets of enlightened people from time to time who understand absolute anchor values of good, absolute anchor values of life. And we could go through some of the examples. It's just that I think what you're saying is true, that civilization as a whole, our culture as a whole, has been nihilistic. And I think that's absolutely true. It's just you can't talk about nihilism if everything is nihilism. There's a bit of a transcendental aperture, a space in being and thinking that, like, even for us to have this conversation right now means that we are pushing off against nihilism. We're looking at it, the fact that we can even talk about it. But that's been my concern, Nazarita. This is really it. It's been my concern that as this virus, this disease, infects us even more, that our ability to talk about it and to think about it decreases. It's like a virus. It's making everybody sick. It's like, you know, the more I learn about American healthcare, sure, there are heroic acts that we see in American healthcare, right? Heroic stories. But as a whole, I think American healthcare falls in line with nihilism, just like government, just like science. I mean, look what we're doing in science. We torture and kill animals in the name of making the human experience better. That's the whole plan. We're going to go torture, research on, harm and murder animals to somehow make the human experience better. And we do the same thing in healthcare. Healthcare is so bureaucratized, and it does not deliver what we want it to deliver. You and I have talked about this. In fact, we could do a year show on it if you want. I'm willing to do that. That's because it's nihilist. And so this is the way nihilism works. A private, fancy, wealthy hospital can point to its brilliant doctors and some of the innovative procedures that they're doing. And yet it's completely driven by capitalism, 100% driven by capitalism. And that's the point of nihilism. These phenomena look good, but they're not good. What about all the people that can't even get into the doctor? They're being pushed out onto the street because they don't have any money. Or people's procedures are regulated by the insurance carrier. That's nihilism. That's what I want everybody to see. It's where a value of destruction outweighs and overrides any other value. Doctors have 10 minutes a visit now in a clinical practice. I talked to two people over the years in recent times from different cities who had the same scripture, 10 minutes per patient. And then on the other side of things, once you get, I used to laugh, there was somebody older than me I used to have a conversation with about this, and he's like, once they get you into the system, they're not going to want to let you go. It's a system of upbilling, upselling, upcoding. And all of a sudden you've left the hospital. You came in with a cold, and all of a sudden you've left the hospital with a $10,000 bill. But these are examples. Or here's another one, Nazarita, that maybe we can discuss. Public school education. The curriculum is determined by the PTA, by the board. They determine which textbooks will be purchased. Think about it. You go to school, grades 1 through 8 or whatever it is. The textbooks have been chosen ideologically. There's a, going back to the church example, which I just have to mention, there's a church in my hometown that's based upon the principles of hunting. Hunting to kill. Church. Nazarita, do you think we're painting a good picture here for our listeners that we're not being negative and we're not even being skeptical? We're observing and perceiving what is. So even though it something might look good, it might not be good.
Well, I thought it was really profound about healthcare, and if you continue to look at healthcare and schools, you see that humans are acclimated, and especially in the United States, to healthcare the way that it is. You expect to go into the doctor. You try and keep your visit as short as possible. You know you're going to be billed, and it's hard to navigate the system unless you have something really wrong. And everybody knows it. Everybody abides by these rules. They know what healthcare is. They know that it's not to give you health. It's to manage disease. And so we all buy into that. And so the rules for healthcare never change because it's like this maddening circle, right? This cycle of which comes first. And so people expect hospitals, they don't demand something different. And so we're stuck in this vicious cycle of bad healthcare. Laws can't be passed that give us, you know, great coverage because there is, as we said, 41% or more who cannot see the value of that. They don't want it. They don't want anything to do with changing healthcare or giving. It isn't so much that they themselves don't want healthcare. They don't want anyone else to have good healthcare. They don't want what they call immigrants or poor people to have good healthcare because they feel it takes away from their healthcare. It's like people don't want to pay taxes for people who are poor. They resent it. They resent doing anything in schools for poor districts because they don't want to encourage the poor to get something on, you know, socialism. And so I look at what's going on now in schools that you brought up is books are banned by not sometimes even the board. They start to be banned by narrow-minded people who cannot see the scope of what who we are or who we could be. They're narrow-minded, they're bigoted, they're hypocritical, and they start to ban these books that should be available to everyone, but they're not. And so schools are in the same situation. I've known many, many teachers. They work for low pay. They are abused. Their job is never secure, and they don't have enough time. They do most of their work for free. And the general populace in the United States supports that. They may say that what a shame teachers don't make money, but who is fighting to get them more money instead of a football player or a basketball player? Who is supporting more money for teachers as opposed to, you know, sports? And that's the dilemma, is that you have this split in humans that would prefer entertainment and power over that which gives knowledge and wisdom and teaches. And then, of course, schools are sued because parents have expectations that teachers should babysit their children. And when the teachers do not babysit their children, they sue them. Parents sue the school board because they didn't take responsibility for their own kids. It's totally corrupt.
Right.
I mean, I think,
well, listen.
Didn't you know?
Well, we're out of time.
Okay.
Yeah, we're just watching the clock here. We've got 30 seconds, so maybe make a closing comment and we'll pick it up next time.
Why don't you make a closing comment? That would be great.
Well, let me just say we're out of time. Thanks. We thank everybody for being here. We'll be back next Monday, same time, to continue this discussion, which is a great learning for me. Thank you, Nazarita. Thanks to me. Thanks to all our listeners. We'll be back to talk about nihilism next Monday. Bye-bye.